Welcome to Recess Now. This is the episode that I've been looking forward to for a while, just because we've been in the thick of all of this stuff for so long. This is the COVID-19 update episode. I'm Ralph Seymour, physician assistant in emergency medicine and critical care.
Jared Barker, ER physician.
So today I have the honor of having two guests on the show, Jared and I do, one of which is the chief intensivist of a ICU in the greater Chicagoland area. She's been a mentor of mine for almost 10 years and has been a huge, has made a huge impact on my career in so many ways that she wouldn't even know that. It's Lavanya Srinivasan, physician and the chief of the intensive care unit. And we're happy to have you here, Dr. Srinivasan. Thank you. And also Dr. Kunal Patel, somebody that I look up to as a mentor, have for years. He was a pulmonary fellow in the institution that we work in, and now he's one of the attending intensivists here. And we're happy to have him weigh in on some of these issues as well. So thank you, Kunal, for coming in. So I guess we'll just get started here on COVID-19 and where we started in the first wave. Jared, I know you remember where we started, what was it, March?
Yeah, it seems like about mid-March is when everything took off.
Yeah, so, you know, that was a strange time in that we started out with a different mindset that has now come 180 degrees, where we were being very aggressive with airway management. And there's been a huge departure from that. Now, what do you think about that, Dr. Patel? The departure away from intubating folks, and what were your experiences when we had these patients on the vent? Maybe sometimes 20 or 30 patients on a vent. How was your experience with that in the first wave?
I think at first we thought that early intubation would be the key to, you know, causing allowing lung protective strategy and giving the patients their best chance. And I think, you know, we were doing this for our first wave of patients. And, you know, we realized very soon that the patients did not fare too well. You know, really not sure if it was the early intubation that led to this or was it just the underlying process. But soon we were kind of, you know, we kind of reassessed our treatment strategy, and we actually ended up pushing for more delaying intubation to a safer, you know, a little longer until we know that it was not safe to keep them without ventilation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I worked with you not only through the emergency department, but also in the ICU. And I remember there were a variety of strategies that we were looking at then. We looked at the low PEEP strategy for ARDS. We looked at the high PEEP strategy. We looked at APRV on many patients as well. And we just couldn't find a formula that was working for everybody. Everybody was a little bit different, and we couldn't quite grasp what was going on there. So here we are today in the second wave, and we've made a departure from that strategy of intubating early, and now we're watching these patients. With respect to watching them, Dr. Patel, how are we able to look at these patients differently in the sense that when you have a patient that is saturating in the 80s, how do you convince your nursing staff that it's okay as long as the patient is saying they feel okay?
It was definitely a big adjustment for all of us to see our comfort level with how hypoxic patients can be. A lot of it was, I think, clinically just watching the patient and just assessing their level of dyspnea, if they were in any distress. And, you know, with we both witnessed patients with saturations in the 60s and the 70s talking full sentences, doing their regular activity in the bed without any issues at all. And my colleagues at other hospitals kind of witnessed the same. So it was very interesting, and it definitely took an adjustment to get ourselves plus the rest of the team accustomed to dealing with this.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it's been a work in progress for everybody. I know Jared and I have, in the emergency department, seeing these patients come in, it was surreal at times. I remember there's been patients you and I had together, right, and we were looking at this patient and they had a good waveform in the 30s and 40s. And they're looking at me and I'm fine.
Right,
dude.
Right.
I don't know, you know, why you're looking at me like that, but I'm breathing just fine. Yeah. And it was at that point that I knew that we were dealing with a disease that none of us really understood very well. And it's been very difficult because the data has been mixed and we have so many medications that we've tried. Let me start with, you know, we know about oxygen. We've been very aggressive with oxygen. Mm-hmm. I think that we now are okay with using BiPAP in most centers. A lot of centers shy away from it still because of the aerosolization. But I think if you have to go with BiPAP, we've been doing it. We've been doing high flow nasal cannula. We've been doing OptiFlow, which is a brand name for like a really high flow nasal cannula that can be titrated in an effective way. Making our way now to medications. We started out with tocilizumab, and I hope I didn't butcher that, but tocilizumab was a medication we were using on everybody, and I think the reason was for the cytokines, to kind of turn that off in some sense. Have we made our way away from that now? Are we using that as much today?
Tocilizumab is an anti-IL-6 medication, or anti-interleukin medication. So essentially, initially, we started using that in all of them where we started seeing the cytokine release. Later on, we started seeing the data that it probably was not making much of a difference, especially in the ones who were severe and those who were there on the ventilator. Then the community as such, the medical community, started moving away from tocilizumab. Of late now, they're kind of slowly reconsidering tocilizumab, that if given early in the moderate disease, you can probably prevent them getting on the ventilator. And mind you, I say that probably prevent doesn't stop. But the minute they kind of have progressed and going on the ventilator, that's a definite no. It's not an indication for them to get the tocilizumab. So it's kind of finding a very fine line.
Okay.
Where you can give these patients tocilizumab and see that it makes a difference.
So it's a select group of folks.
Moderate ARDS.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. It's sometimes hard to find the right patient for the right drug. And I think maybe just like throwing this at everybody, maybe not the right thing now in the second wave. Maybe we're looking at it differently in retrospect, saying that, okay, some patients can get tocilizumab.
Right.
Okay. Now, I'm going to move now into melatonin, vitamin C, Pepcid. Are you kidding me? Zinc? So these are things that my mom told me I should take when I was little to fight the common cold. Is this really where we're at right now?
There is actually some data, if not strong, just weak data, which actually quotes melatonin, that it has a fair percentage of reduction in the viremia. Is it proven in multiple cases, multiple studies? No.
Okay.
We don't know that, but we have that. Pepcid, again, it goes back to a study that came out of New York, which was very similar. There is a mild reduction in viremia that was noted.
Okay.
Vitamin C, high-dose vitamin C, has gone around so many times with so many studies.
The Merrick protocol was extremely high on vitamin C, thiamine, and hydrocortisone. I think vitamin C has been around the world a lot as an antiviral for many years. So.
Not just as an antiviral. It's used as anti-everything for many. And the best part is it's a water-soluble vitamin. You don't lose anything by giving it a high dose.
Fair.
So you give it to them, they get a benefit, fair enough. But you just need to be aware that it can spuriously elevate your AccuChecks. You just got to be aware of that.
Sure.
And that's about it.
Sure. No, I like that. I think the most important driving point home on these things is the medicines that I just mentioned, and with an overtone of sarcasm, but I was just being funny, is that these medications, for the most part, do no harm. Okay, we have vitamin C, we have Pepcid, we have zinc, and we have what was the other one that I mentioned? Melatonin. These are the compounds that are not going to do harm. And if they could potentially help, then it's probably good to add to the regimen as an inpatient. Is that fair? So, okay. So that we're moving on now to the remdesivir fiasco that we have. We've been giving remdesivir. I think most institutions have been giving remdesivir. And there's been some data that has been positive with remdesivir. There's been some data that's been not so positive. Dr. Patel, where are we at with remdesivir?
I think with the recent updates, it actually recommends that remdesivir probably doesn't have much benefit to the patients that we typically admit to the hospital. Once they're, you know, the patients have kind of progressed from a viral illness to more of a cytokine release, like picture where they're developing pneumonia, hypoxia, and more systemic illness. You know, the data kind of supports that remdesivir is probably not efficacious. And, you know, that's even at this point there, even, you know, we found recommendations that even patients who are progressing to respiratory failure, that remdesivir is probably has little benefit to these patients. So kind of, I guess, the main driving point is that with all these patients with coronavirus, a lot of it depends on the timing of which therapy is started. If a patient is coming in or presenting early on into the course, oftentimes I think these patients tend to do well and we're probably able to halt their progression, although it's kind of tough to measure. Are they getting better on their own or is it due to the treatment? But definitely what we seen at the beginning of the first wave back in March is that patients progressed or presented to the ER at a very late stage. And I think no matter what treatments we gave, what type of strategies of treatment we did, probably was not effective for them. Mm. And, you know, we do still see patients that come in later in the course, and we still see a similar picture.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Timing is the key in all these patients that we need to be aware, as he rightfully pointed out, that at the end of the day, the more you keep it simple, it works out easier for these patients, and maybe they get better on their own. They just need support. On that note, one point that I would kind of add on to a prior question is the modes of ventilation. The key thing is going to be prone. Mm-hmm. Prone ventilation. If they are awake, awake proning is going to be a key thing to be considered in these patients.
So that was an excellent thing you brought up about proning. I think it's something that we have all taken into our toolbox a little bit with taking care of these folks. How should we be proning these patients, or how often, I should say, Dr. Srinivasan, should we be proning these patients or changing their position in the emergency department and in the intensive care unit? What should be the timing of that?
If a patient is in ARDS or full mechanical ventilation requiring 100% FiO2 and a high fee, you want to start early proning. So if they're there in the ER, start proning them. The timing goes based on the data that we have is 16-8. That is, they're prone for 16 hours and they're supine for 8.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, that's good enough. And when they're not on a ventilator, and they're actually on high-flow nasal cannula, should we be asking them to change their position to their belly as much as possible?
Yes, we still encourage them to prone as much as possible, and some of them can't go on their belly, so then we encourage them at least to go side to side, but avoid just lying in one position. The key thing is to just keep moving. Okay. Not just lying in bed in one position.
Okay, fair enough. Now, this is now going into the dreadful coagulopathy that is COVID-19. And where we started out and where we have ended up today, we have always felt very confident with the holster of our guns. One holster has heparin, and then the other one has Lovenox. And we always feel very confident that we can combat most coagulopathies with those weapons. I don't know that that has been necessarily the truth with COVID-19 at times. It's been very unpredictable. The coagulopathy that has been brought forth by this disease process has been unpredictable, to say the least. Where are we at now with our strategy in taking care of these coagulopathies? And by that, I mean patients that seem to be clotting. And there's been people that have given us an idea that the microcirculation in the lungs may be clotting. I don't know that we necessarily have proof of that. But what are we doing for the coagulopathy now? Is it full dose Lovenox? Is it heparin? Is it other things? What are we doing?
For patients on mechanical ventilation, we go with full dose Lovenox or heparin if they are in renal failure and they cannot go on Lovenox. Anybody who's in the intermediate range, then they talk about at least going 0.5 milligram per kg twice a day to at least make sure that with the Lovenox, to make sure at least they are anticoagulated fair enough.
Yeah.
To state that to prevent the progression of the coagulopathy is where it kind of ends up being. The most of the information that we get is based on all the postmortem reports that slowly are flowing in on these patients, that they have seen these clots in the lungs, clots everywhere, arterial and venous thrombi that develop in these patients. So just to find a balance to see how it helps them.
Sure, sure. So that's more of what it is finding a balance. And what are we using as a measure of success? Are we using the D-dimer? Necessarily? Are we using the elevation of the inflammatory markers on a daily basis to measure how we're progressing, how we're doing? Are we better? Are we worse? How are we doing that, Dr. Patel? Or how are you doing that more particularly?
I tend to trend the D-dimers pretty consistently along with CRP. I haven't really found much utility in trending the LDH and the ferritin levels. Specifically the D-dimer, kind of when I initially, see the patient, that kind of serves as a basis, to which what type of anticoagulation I'm going to give the patient. If they require just a DVT prophylaxis, maybe a half weight dose or full dose. And of course, during this time, we're going to rule out any signs of, obvious DVT or PE. Also clinical presentation. I think we've experienced patients who have had lower or mildly elevated D-dimers, where you can clinically see that their D-dimers continue to increase along with worsening hypoxia and worsening infiltrates on the X-ray. So I think at that point, it's kind of up to the clinician to, at this point, think, should a full dose be started or not? Yeah. And I've noticed this on the flip side as well, due to patients bleeding in the ICU, anticoagulation had to be held. And almost instantly, within the next 24 hours, we see the D-dimer increasing, the patient progressively getting hypoxic, and even patients passing away as a result of it.
Yeah.
So I think there's a strong correlation with D-dimer. And even though you're on full anticoagulation, it may not be enough, but maybe enough to buy the patient enough time to allow for recovery.
Sure, sure. And with heparin, I anecdote time, I've seen a case of what appeared to be heparin resistance in the face of this disease. And it's actually a little bit daunting when a pharmacist calls you and says, I don't know how to get this person therapeutic. And, again, we're not used to seeing things like this, and I think we have to kind of, take it as it comes almost, Right. I don't know if the heparin resistance is a real thing or if it's something you've seen at all, either of you. I've seen it one time. It's an anecdote. I haven't read much about it, but it was pretty significant.
Well, I think we were talking about the same patient that we dealt with, and I've heard anecdotally from colleagues at other centers that the resistance with heparin or difficulty achieving therapeutic anticoagulation with heparin has been pretty challenging for a lot of places. And oftentimes have to be creative or use other agents as well.
Yeah.
So definitely I think heparin is, it seems like it's not as effective, but again, there's not much data in regards for it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been somewhat of a microcosm of hell at times when we're taking care of these patients, Dr. Barker. And I know that we have been trying to learn from you folks on a daily basis of how we can bring upstairs care downstairs, to take a script out of the Weingart book, because right now we're boarding so many folks and we're trying to deliver the care that they should receive earlier in the emergency department. So I know I've learned a great deal from both of you in that way, trying to get the remdesivir started. If that's what we're going to do, we'll get it started early. Let's get the anticoagulation started early. And I shouldn't forget Decadron. I don't want to talk about data, but I do want to talk about how have you perceived patients' recovery with Decadron, dexamethasone, as opposed to different strategies in the past with solumedrol, let's say.
Well, I think the one thing we both kind of learned and kind of bit the bullet on early on was, before even the Decadron data was there or the recommendations, you know, at some point we noticed our patients were just not surviving this. And, you know, the initial concern of starting steroids in early stages of viremia would just cause it to progress. At some point, you know, we kind of took a calculated risk and started these patients on 1 mg per kilo solumedrol, which is more or less what the equivalent of Decadron is. And I think, you know, we started that early and, you know, it was kind of confirmed with the studies with Decadron. So in terms of steroids, I don't think there's a difference between the agents that you use. It was the studied drug was with dexamethasone, and that's kind of what we're using now. But in terms of its efficacy, I think if as long as you're giving an appropriate dose-adjusted Decadron to solumedrol or prednisone, I think it's I would suspect there would be equivalent.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Fair enough. So we've talked about Decadron. We've talked about anticoagulation. We've talked about the confounding coagulopathy that is COVID-19. We've talked about vitamin C and company. We've talked about all kinds of things as it relates to treating this disease. This has been an interesting talk, and I wanted to thank both of you again for taking the time out of your busy schedules. I know how busy you are. We're all busy together, and I want to ask you both, what have we not talked about that either of you wish we had? Is there something that you'd like to say about the management today, as we are in the second wave of COVID-19, that all the practitioners that listen to this program should know? What haven't we brought up,
Dr. Wear a mask.
Wear a mask. Okay, fair. That's fair.
Wear a mask, social distance, and wash hands. The simple things makes a huge difference, even in the outpatient setting, and especially even in the inpatient side.
Okay.
Just to make sure that you know that you're aware, you know that it's a pandemic, and making sure that you follow the exact same rules as what is being recommended.
Fair enough. Yeah. Wearing your mask, practicing good hand washing skills. Don't get away from the basics, folks. You want to cut down the transmission of this virus in the community. And also, when you're a healthcare worker, same thing applies. Good hygiene, wear a mask all the time. Don't let your guard down, I think, is the main driving point of that. Dr. Patel, is there anything that we didn't mention here that you wish we had? Or, you know, with respect, you and I have talked about outpatient management a little bit and what certain clinicians in the primary care setting are doing. Now, look, this is a resuscitation podcast, and I'm not going to talk a whole lot about primary care medicine. But if we need to extend out to the primary care folks about what they should be prescribing these patients in the home when they're oxygenating okay, and they don't need to come to the hospital, from a pulmonary intensive care physician, what would you tell these folks?
I think a lot of it is for the patients that, you know, they should still see their primary doctor or be in discussion with them when if they are sick or if they become tested positive. And I think most importantly, I think it would be a big help for the, you know, the outpatient centers to kind of keep close tabs on these patients to see how they're doing, you know, rather than the typical, you know, give some treatment and see how they do. Sometimes just a quick follow-up to see how the patients are doing can really identify which patients need to come in and which do not. And I think for the both of us in our pulmonary outpatient clinic, we do that more or less. And we're able to kind of judge roughly, you know, and tell a patient now is the time to come into the hospital. And I think, you know, getting a patient in the right time to the hospital or the emergency room can really help prevent someone from progressing into a more severe disease. And again, it's difficult and it requires a lot of communication. But that would definitely be one thing to help.
Okay, so we've gone through pretty much everything. We've extended our hand out to the community with some advice from the intensive care physicians. Dr. Barker and I are humbled and honored to have you both take the time out of our obviously busy schedule and your busy schedule, and everything has been stressful. The one thing I touched upon on the last 5-minute bit is being kind to one another, folks. Be kind to one another. Help the nurses, compliment the nurses on a job well done when they do a good job. The techs, the ancillary staff, be kind to each other. Say good job, or and I appreciate what you're doing on a daily basis, because everybody's stressed out. Everybody's at the max of what they can tolerate. And I think it's very important that we are in this together. We should treat each other like family. And I really believe that. And that's how we do things here at our institution. And I hope that's what you adopt in your own institution or station as a paramedic or an EMT. So thank you, Dr. Srinivasan and Dr. Patel, for joining us today on this COVID-19 update. Please tune in for our next episode to be announced. Don't forget to check out our show notes for evidence-related articles on topics from today's show. Email questions to rhesusnowquestions@gmail.com. Check out our hosting site, rhesusnow.buzzsprout.com. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Reddit, all the stuff, right? Available on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you consume your podcast, folks. We're there. This is always Alonzo Villa for your masterful artwork that you donated to the show. Don't forget about rhesusleadershipacademy.com for the virtual fellowship of Dr. Scott Weingart. And as always, I'm Ralph Seymour. And we will see you guys next time. Thank you, Dr. Srinivasan and Dr. Patel.
Thank you.